This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
I will say good evening and welcome to the Keynes Seminar. And for those of you who don't know me, my name is Mark Hayes, fellow in economics here at Robinson College and the organiser of the seminar. And tonight I have great pleasure in introducing two speakers, Professor Roger Backhouse, who will give the main paper, which he has co-authored with Professor Bradley Bateman of Denison University, who cannot be present, and Professor Roberto Scazzieri, who will respond. Roger is Professor of the History and Philosophy of Economics at the University of Birmingham, here in England. His current areas of research, I understand from his website, include early 20th century welfare economics, Keynes, disequilibrium macroeconomics, and the history of recent, that is, post-1945, social science. And he co-edited with Bradley Bateman the recent Cambridge Companion to Keynes. Roberto is Professor of Economics at the University of Bologna, and he's also a member of Clare Hall, and one of the organisers of a Cambridge seminar in the history of economic analysis, which takes place regularly next door. And he has a very wide range of research interests, including the history of economic analysis, obviously, and recently he published Market, Money and Capital, or is it Markets, Money and Capital?
Markets, I think.
Yeah, Hicksian Economics for the 21st Century, which was a volume edited in collaboration with Amartya Sen and Stefano Zamagni. So I believe that between the two of them, our speakers are very well placed to offer a dispassionate view of post-Keynesian economics and its relation to the economics of Keynes. Though Roger has promised me that this is not going to be a simple opposition of the two. But I'm looking forward very much to hearing what he has to say. So, Roger, over to you.
Well, thank you very much for your your kind introduction. Yes, as you have said, the paper is jointly written with Brad Bateman. And on the other hand, what I say today, wherever it departs from the paper, I have to take responsibility. So if it's in the written version, which you can read afterwards, we share responsibility. If it's not, then you can blame it all on me. It draws not so much on the sort of Cambridge Companion to Keynes as on a book which Brad and I have got coming out this autumn, which we call, which is coming out under the title Capitalist Revolutionary, John Maynard Keynes. So the part, some of the ideas are drawn from that. And these are ideas which we started thinking about after editing the Cambridge Companion, because editing that book and reading carefully the contributions to that book made us think about aspects of Keynes which we felt hadn't been looked at. Now, the title of the talk borrows obviously from the title of Axel Leonhufvud's great book, and so you may think that we're going to provide a detailed analysis of the analytical errors of post-Keynesian economics, setting up an opposition between it and the theory that John Maynard Keynes developed in the general theory. However, this is not the line we, or perhaps I should say, sometimes I'll probably say we, sometimes I, they mean the same thing with the qualification I gave before. This is not the line we intend to pursue. So we're not challenging, for example, the interpretation offered by Mark, who sought to identify a consistent theoretical framework within the general theory. Instead, we want to challenge the claim, the post-Keynesian claim, almost to exclusive rights over Keynes' legacy, that their ideas are, to use the metaphor popularised by Joan Robinson, about which I'm going to talk quite a bit, the legitimate progeny of the general theory, and that mainstream Keynesianism is not. Now, our contention is that to make such a claim in relation to the general theory is to take a position that's very different from the one that Keynes himself took. So the Samuelsonian neoclassical synthesis, or the new Keynesian macroeconomics, we contend, are no more Keynes' bastard progeny than are the various strands of post-Keynesian economics. Now, in saying this, we are not claiming that some interpretations of Keynes are better than others. There are some of which we are as critical as anyone in this room. But we are claiming that the range of legitimate interpretations is much wider than we feel the post-Keynesian literature generally admits. So our first stage in this argument is to establish the centrality to post-Keynesian economics of the idea that mainstream Keynesianism, from Hicksian ISLM analysis and the Samuelsonian neoclassical synthesis to the new Keynesianism, is, to use Robinson's much quoted term, bastard Keynesianism. And then, drawing on a recent paper, we talk about Keynes' attitude to economic theory and to his own legacy. And in particular, we explore why Keynes didn't try to constrain more narrowly the ways in which his work was taken up. Now, clearly, the decade after the general theory was published was when Keynes was seriously ill with a heart problem, and in which his main concerns lay elsewhere, not least with financing Britain's war effort and making plans for a post-war economic order that would be better than the one that failed so disastrously in the 1930s. Yet we argue that his tolerance of different interpretations of his work went further than having other preoccupations, and they stemmed from deep moral and philosophical convictions rooted in Bloomsbury that raised serious questions about applying the notions of legitimacy and illegitimacy to his work. So we start off by looking at post-Keynesian economics, and then we turn to Keynes. Now, here I may abbreviate part of what's in the paper because this may be familiar, and I'm going to try to adjust to meet Mark's target of finishing at 6:15, I think, if I've calculated correctly, 6:15 to 6:20. So post-Keynesian economics has a history, I'm going to suggest, that goes back to the 1970s. Some post-Keynesians, of whom John King is the most notable example, trace its history right back to the general theory. But although the term was used in the 1950s, as in, say, Kenneth Kurihara's book, its meaning was completely different then, including within its compass those who would now be considered highly orthodox, neoclassical, or even hydraulic Keynesians. We'd prefer to follow scholars like Fred Lee or Tiago Mata, who have argued that although some of the crucial ideas had been developed earlier, post-Keynesianism, as the term is now understood, emerged only in the 1970s when a group of economists began to organise under the post-Keynesian banner to signal their opposition to what had become the Keynesian orthodoxy that was under increasing attack from monetarist and neoclassical opponents. Like those who would resurrect classical doctrines, the post-Keynesians accepted the need for change, but they claimed it could be found not by abandoning Keynes, but by reconstructing Keynesian economics to get away from the etiolated vision found in the textbooks. What made the events of the early 70s so significant was that this is the period when post-Keynesians established themselves as a self-consciously heterodox group standing outside the mainstream of the discipline. And their calls for a reconstruction of economics went beyond simply trying to get Keynes right. Whereas in the 1950s and 1960s, Joan Robinson and Sidney Weintraub, for example, had published in the same journals, engaging with their more orthodox counterparts, from the 1970s, post-Keynesians began from necessity as much as from choice to publish elsewhere. Now, to reconstruct Keynesian economics, it was necessary to adopt one of two routes. One was to turn back to Keynes' own text and to find in it ideas that had been neglected or misunderstood. This was the strategy of Paul Davidson, following the example of forerunners such as Sidney Weintraub, Hyman Minsky, or George Shackle. The alternative route, followed by Joan Robinson, Jan Kregel, Alfred Eichner, was to combine Keynesianism with ideas taken from Mikhail Kaletsky or Joan Robinson's extension of Keynesian economics to the classical long run, represented in the Ricardian Marxian theory of value and capital as recast by Piero Sraffa. Now, common to both of these routes was a rejection of what was often, following Robinson's terminology, labelled bastard Keynesianism. This was the Keynesianism of the neoclassical synthesis, represented above all by the ISLM diagram of John Hicks and Alvin Hansen, and the 45-degree line diagram of Paul Samuelson. Indeed, it was Samuelson who, in the third edition of his textbook, had coined the phrase neoclassical synthesis. Now, the term bastard Keynesianism, though it may have been used earlier in correspondence by Sidney Weintraub, appeared in print in a review by Robinson of Harry Johnson's Money, Trade and Economic Growth, in which she focused on one chapter, originally given as a lecture to the AEA, the general theory after 25 years. Johnson had closed that lecture by observing it was impossible in a single lecture, quote, to take a census of the progeny of the general theory. Robinson seems to have taken up this remark about the general theory's progeny to observe that Johnson was neither old enough to have had first-hand experience of pre-Keynesian economics, nor young enough to realise he needed to find out what it was. Instead of discussing the changes actually brought about, he had confronted Keynes' theory with, quote, its own bastard progeny. Now, in Economic Heresies, in 1970, she implied that this bastard progeny included Milton Friedman's quantitative theory, citing Potinkin's work in support. Now, though this bastard progeny included the modern quantity theory, Robinson also denied the legitimacy of the Keynesianism of the neoclassical synthesis. In her lecture, immediately after explaining how Hicks and Mead had misrepresented Keynes, she referred to the bastard Keynesians who used arguments which are purely Keynesian, though formalistic and silly, and seriously defective in logic. So being a bastard Keynesian just thus involved using Keynesian ideas, but in a way that missed the point of what Keynes was trying to say, usually because it involved expressing his ideas in mathematical model that made precise things that Keynes had left vague. Though she didn't use the term ISLM, the arguments she criticised could have come from almost any textbook based around the ISLM model. And she criticised this explicitly in Economic Heresies, claiming that Axel Leonhufvud had destroyed it, quote, by its own internal contradictions. Now, our contention is that this opposition to bastard Keynesianism, or some equivalent, was important in the constitution of post-Keynesian economics in the 1970s. Post-Keynesians were united in their opposition to the Keynesian orthodoxy that was falling out of favour, but for many years hadn't agreed on the approach that should be followed as an alternative. In their much-cited survey, written a decade after Eichner and Kregel drew attention to post-Keynesian economics in the pages of the Journal of Economic Literature, Omar Hamouda and Geoffrey Harcourt made a virtue of this. The essence of post-Keynesian economics, they argued, was its horses-for-courses approach to economic theory, combining the ideas of Keynes, Kaletsky and Sraffa. They reinforced each other. Sheila Dow then called this approach Babylonian, contrasting it with the Cartesian Euclidean approach, with its emphasis on precise axioms and logical rigour. Harcourt and Hamouda came close to conceding that the only unifying feature of post-Keynesian economics was the desire to find an alternative to mainstream neoclassical theory in the ISLM general equilibrium versions of Keynesian theory, for it comprised approaches that differed in method and assumptions about the world that were incorporated in those models. Take away, and this perhaps is the key point, take away the opposition to neoclassical orthodoxy and its bastard Keynesianism, and it would be harder to maintain any semblance of unity. And this is what Robert Solow summed up when he wrote, "I don't see the intellectual connection between a Hyman Minsky and someone like Alfred Eichner, except they're all against the same thing, namely the mainstream, whatever that is. it seems to be mostly a community that knows what it's against but doesn't offer anything very systematic that could be described as a positive theory. Now, this situation, this disunity, arose in part because there were significant differences between the situations in the United States and Britain. In the United States, post-Keynesianism had a much clearer identity because of the student-teacher relationships between Weintraub, Davidson and Kregel, and because it achieved an institutional presence in a small number of universities, such as Rutgers and Amherst. In contrast, in Britain, though Joan Robinson was the iconic figure on account of her association with Keynes and the Cambridge Circus and her role in questioning the neoclassical theory of capital, and though Cambridge was the central institution, the institutional links were closer, resulting in a variety of approaches. Now, there were strong transatlantic links. Kregel, a student of Davidson, was close to Robinson, and Victoria Chick was taught by Minsky at Berkeley. But these links were not sufficient to bring about a shared set of beliefs on the basis of which a common identity could be created. Now, in recent years, post-Keynesians have managed to achieve a greater sense of unity, this being forged around a focus on uncertainty as the key in Keynesian insight, the position long taken by Davidson and Minsky, those inspired by Schraffer and the capital controversy, in some ways closer to Marx than someone like Davidson, who were never as influential in the United States as in Europe, have not disappeared but have just gone their own way. As a result, agreement has formed amongst many post-Keynesians that there is a need for an open systems methodology, sometimes but not always linked to Tony Lawson's critical realism. So in the second edition of Dower's Survey of Schools of Macroeconomic Thought, written 11 years after the first, she introduced closed and open systems methodology to supplement her distinction between the Cartesian, Euclidean and Babylonian modes of thought, which around which the first edition was structured. And in his recent account of post-Keynesian methodology, Jesper Jespersen adopts a similar approach, linking it specifically with critical realism. Now, others don't make this last link, though the connection between uncertainty and open systems theorising is very widely made. So the Schraffian and Kaletskian approaches have become less prominent in post-Keynesian economics, less prominent than the uncertainty approach represented most characteristically, perhaps by Paul Davidson or Victoria Chick. Since the financial crisis of 2008, when awareness of financial instability and expectations burst into the public arena, Davidson's view has really been prominent, certainly in the press, I think, especially with the author of the major biography of Keynes, Robert Skidelsky, increasingly taking a very similar position. The Cambridge capital controversy is central to the creation of a post-Keynesian identity in some ways in the 1970s, received less and less attention. However, I would suggest that despite the emergence of a less fragmented post-Keynesian view, it can be argued that post-Keynesian economics still defines itself in oppositions of versions of Keynesian economics that are considered illegitimate representations of Keynes' ideas. There is considerable imprecision, for example, on what open systems theorising involves. Certainly, I would suggest, and I feel rather reticent about saying this given the audience I have in front of me, not enough precision there in order to build a research programme on it. It is so broad it can encompass approaches that have very different heuristics. Such a broad methodological stance needs to be supplemented with substantive beliefs about the economy of post-Keynesian economics as to be distinguished from mainstream economics, which is in practice far more flexible and open-ended than the widespread emphasis on rigour and formal modelling suggests. Now, one might have thought that post-Keynesians would have embraced some of the approaches taken by the new Keynesians who emerged in and after the 1970s, for they've sought in a very eclectic way, this is the new Keynesians, to challenge the classical presuppositions about how competitive markets work. And recent behavioural economics would seem to have much in common with the way Keynes himself analysed behaviour in financial markets, something that George Akerlof, in his widely discussed presidential address to the AEA, has noted. However, post-Keynesians have mostly distanced themselves very sharply from such developments. Jespersen argues there is a clear methodological divide, while Davidson focuses on the non-ergodicity of economic systems and the assumption of sticky wages. So, the argument so far is that this opposition to something which we could call bastard Keynesianism, even if the term is not used, is central to this identity. What I now want to go on to is to think about Keynes and Keynes' attitude to economic theory. And then I want to go on to Keynes' opposition to dogma and to suggest what we rather boldly, I can use we here because it's in my written text in front of me, what we rather boldly call towards a richer Keynesian economics. So what about Keynes' attitude to economic theory, which I think is central to these discussions? We take up the point that Kevin Hoover made in his chapter in the Cambridge Companion, that Keynes was trying to produce what Hoover calls, a diagnostic science. Keynes was like a physician trying to diagnose the problems of the economic body. And theory was a device for doing this. So theory was driven by a concern for policy. He didn't construct economic theories for their own sake, but because existing theories were not serviceable as a basis on which to draw policy conclusions. So he is a physician diagnosing problems with the economic body and prescribing solutions. Now, this view of Keynes' attitude to economic theory is consistent with the appraisal offered by Austin Robinson in 1947, straight after Keynes' death. Keynes' greatness, Robinson argued, lay in his having brought together economic theory and policy at a time when they were drifting apart. And he found the consistency in Keynes' career through his having placed certain objectives, noticeably full employment, at the heart of the policy agenda. So this is one thing about Keynes' attitude to economic theory. It was in the service of economic policy. Another crucial dimension of Keynes' attitude was the importance he attached to intuition. As he explained, his starting point was intuition or vision, the grey, fuzzy, woolly monster in his head, as he described it. However, he then went on to make arguments more precise, but he believed it was impossible to be completely precise. So we find in the general theory a critique of the use of formal mathematics. And there is a quotation which is probably well known, so I'll read it because it's a nice quotation. "It's a great fault of symbolic pseudo-mathematical method of formalizing a system of economic analysis that they assume strict independence between the factors involved and lose all their cogency and authority if this hypothesis is disallowed. Too large a proportion of recent mathematical economics are merely concoctions as imprecise as the initial assumptions they rest on, which allow the author to lose sight of the complexities and interdependencies of the real world in a maze of pretentious and unhelpful symbols." Such passages are no doubt music to post-Keynesian ears. We don't want to minimise their importance or their applicability to much economic theorising since the general theory. However, and this is our departure, I think, we suggest there is an important tension in the general theory. Keynes was indeed a sceptic about taking formal mathematical methods too far. We can clearly say that he was a critic of formalism, but he nonetheless used mathematical arguments. Though his accounts of the key relationships, such as the marginal propensity to consume, liquidity preference, and the marginal efficiency of capital, contain much intuitive informal theory, and though he rejected some models he might have used, such as his friend Frank Ramsey's model of saving, published in the journal of which Keynes was the editor, mathematical language and reasoning pervades the book, and he did provide a simple mathematical model of several parts of his theory. Thus, although he may not have put these bits together to form the ISLM model, and maybe he had reasons why he did not do that, all the components of that model were in the general theory. So although Keynes didn't confine himself to a simple formal model, there is a model in there. Furthermore, the model that can be found in the general theory, we contend, is what Hicks and others later extracted as the ISLM model, and it was an important part of the book's argument. Now, if you judge the book by the number of pages containing algebra, the general theory is not a mathematical book. However, if you remove all the pages that use algebra, the book is completely eviscerated. The points at which Keynes uses algebra include some of the most crucial parts of his argument, notably the determination of effective demand. Now, there are other reasons you can use to argue that mathematics was important, and I've explored that elsewhere. So, to understand Keynes' attitude to economic theory, I think it's helpful to return to the example used earlier on. How might Keynes have responded to recent behavioural economics? Our contention is that even if he was sceptical about it, and we concede that he might have treated it with enormous scepticism, he would have encouraged those who were developing the field. The evidence on which we base this is that in the decade after he wrote the general theory, he didn't try to prescribe the correct way to interpret his book. Now, in his very famous and very important restatement of his ideas in the QJE, he does say very clearly that the fault of the classical theory lay in its neglect of uncertainty about the future that could be and that this could not be reduced to calculable numerical probabilities. Yet in that article he also wrote, and I quote now, "I am more attached to the comparatively simple fundamental ideas which underlie my theory than to the particular forms in which I have embodied them, and I have no desire that the latter should be crystallized at the present stage of the debate. If the simple basic ideas can become familiar and acceptable, time and experience and the collaboration of a number of minds will discover the best way of expressing them." Now, this passage can be read in different ways, but it suggests considerable modesty as regards the specific formulations of his ideas. This perhaps explains why he didn't want to respond to eminent critics like Jacob Viner and Pigou in detail about their criticisms. Now, this modesty makes sense of his oft-quoted remark to John Hicks that he found the ISLM model paper really interesting and that he had next to nothing to say by way of criticism. It makes sense of his encouragement of Abba Lerner, Brian Redaway, James Bryce, James Mead, Richard Stone and Joan Robinson, who were developing his ideas in very different ways, some of which amounted to what was later called bastard Keynesianism. Nowhere in the voluminous correspondence after the publication of the general theory does he tell anyone they must adhere exactly to the form of the models in the general theory. He even praised the paper in which Roy Harrod says, "Mr. Keynes has not effected a revolution in fundamental economic theory, but a readjustment and a shift in emphasis." So in the same way that Keynes could encourage young economic theorists who were using methods that he did not himself use, and he could encourage econometricians about whose work he remains sceptical, it would seem very likely that he would have seen behavioural economics as one way to explore and develop his ideas. Ideas to which he attached great importance, namely, how did people behave when faced with the problem of acting in an uncertain world? And this openness to different interpretations fits in with his view that economics is a diagnostic science. Keynes had crucial basic beliefs about how capitalist economies worked that he considered crucial. The most important being that while capitalist economies can sometimes perform well for long periods of time, they can also become unstable because of speculation, the result being prolonged periods of unemployment. He also believed that investment played a major role in this process, and that policymakers had both the power and responsibility to take remedial action. To be usable, these intuitions had to be instantiated in an economic theory, as he had done in the general theory. For this helped justify the policy recommendations. However, having done this, he was then happy for others to develop alternative forms of the theory by formalising his ideas in different ways within different theoretical frameworks. So this, we suggest, is Kane's attitude to economic theory, a much more open attitude than many post-war Keynesians, and here I include all strands of Keynesian, mainstream Keynesians as much as anyone else. Keynes had a much more open attitude than many of his followers did. However, this, I think, fits in with Keynes' philosophy, and here I take the story closer to Bloomsbury. And I now go on to a section called Keynes' Opposition to Dogma. Keynes, I suggest, would have sympathised with Paul Samuelson's outburst against the unreconstructed Keynesians he met at the 100th anniversary celebration of Keynes' birth. And I quote, this is Paul Samuelson, not Keynes, if you'll forgive a quotation from someone other than Keynes. I actually did not like a certain note I thought I detected at the 100th anniversary of Keynes' birth, celebrated at the Holy of Holies, King's College, Cambridge. Person after person got up, walked the sawdust trail and said, I am just as firm a Keynesian as I ever was. I am an unreconstructed Keynesian. And I finally exploded and said, we don't want unreconstructed Keynesians. We want people who will carry the scientific analysis further. In fact, Keynes was explicit that he did not value on holding on to old theoretical constructs when one's basic insights had changed. By 1937, and some readers of an earlier paper thought we must be referring to remarks he made after the Treatise on Money, but no, we're talking about remarks he made after the general theory. He was already looking to move on from the general theory, as he explained in a letter to Joan Robinson. He encouraged her to go ahead with her new book, which he described as practically following my general theory. But then he wrote, I'm gradually getting myself into an outside position towards the book, and I'm feeling my way to new lines of exposition. In correspondence with Richard Kahn, Keynes referred to the efforts of Dennis Robertson and Pigou to hold on to their old theories in the face of their newfound support for public works as a sort of society for the preservation of ancient monuments. However, even if Keynes would have agreed with the anti-dogmatism of Samuelson's remark, as we suggest he would never have expressed it in the same language. His opposition to dogma was not framed in terms of economic science, but it followed from his early experience in Bloomsbury, where he learned to develop strong opinions while always refusing to hold them up as a new orthodoxy. His friend Roger Fry, for example, explained why he never considers a subject finished in words that could have been used by Keynes. I have always looked on my system with a certain suspicion. I have recognised that if it ever formed too solid a crust, it might stop the inlets of fresh experience. The members of the Bloomsbury group never considered any subject settled. One of their central tenets was that they wanted to debunk myths and undercut dogma. This trait is evident in their painting, in their novels, in their biographical writings, in their social commentary. And Crawford Goodwin has probably made this feature of Bloomsbury most evident and has gone further than anyone in demonstrating how the ideal of reason over dogma was as central to Maynard Keynes's work as it was to that of any other member of Bloomsbury. And I quote, Keynes found that the political economy of Great Britain extending from the 19th century into the 20th, like the rest of British culture, cried out for liberation from dogma and superstition. He expressed the importance of avoiding dogmatism in economic matters very clearly in an interview with the New Statesman in 1934. Shaw and Stalin looked backwards to what capitalism was, not forward to what it is becoming. That is the fate of those who dogmatise in the social and economic sphere where evolution is proceeding at a dizzy pace from one form of society to another. Now, A few weeks after that, he wrote his famous letter to Shaw, in which he said he was writing a book that would largely revolutionise the way the world thinks about economic problems. However, he immediately followed that remark by saying that the theory would be mixed with politics, feelings and passions, and he could not predict what the outcome would be. Now, Bloomsbury's attitude to dogma is important if we're to understand the much-quoted sentence from the introduction to the general theory, in which Keynes talks about the struggle of escape from habitual modes of thought and expression. Clearly, this is about escape from classical theory. But I think it's important to read it as reflecting a deeply held belief about the danger of dogma in general, rather than simply about a danger that is peculiar to classical theory. And I quote, "The difficulty lies not in the new ideas, but in escaping the old ones, which ramify for those brought up, as most of us have been, into every corner of our minds." This was something Keynes believed was a general problem that went much further than classical economics. And we'd also suggest that this hostility to dogma extended not merely to classical economics, but to his own work. He was dogmatic in his assertion that economic theory must recognise the fact of mass unemployment and the inherent instability of capitalism, but that wasn't enough to define a theory. This opposition to dogmatism explains why, in the QJE article, he expressed flexibility about the form in which his ideas might be represented, and why, as early as 1937, he could write, as we've just pointed out, that he was feeling his way towards new ways of exposition. It explains why he would encourage the young Keynesians who were developing his ideas in very different directions. Now, Keynes is someone for whom art was one of the highest ends in life. The ideal occupation for Keynes, following Moore, was to be an artist. Keynes may have chosen a career in economics, but this didn't apply. He had abandoned the ideals that motivated Bloomsbury's art. One of these motivations was a respect for and encouragement of creativity. So it is striking that in each of the cases in which he dealt with a younger economist trying to expand on the model of the general theory, he was generous in his praise and encouraged the efforts. Avoidance of dogma and adopting an open and liberal attitude towards those who developed his work in directions different from his own indicate someone who eschewed dogma. Avoidance of dogma involved being creative and open-minded but modest at the same time. So hence we have the quotation, "If we can get economists to think of themselves as humble, competent people on a level with dentists, that would be splendid." The attitude towards the general theory was that of an artist to his or her work. It was to be released into the world, not guarded and preserved. So, I can now conclude, and I may finish in slightly less than 40 minutes. Our central argument is that Keynes encouraged other economists to take his ideas and develop them in different directions. One implication of this is that the accusation made by Joan Robinson and many post-Keynesians, not all, but many, that the neoclassical synthesis Keynesianism and even the new Keynesianism are illegitimate is to miss the point. The concept of legitimacy and illegitimacy, as these ideas are understood in the notion of bastard Keynesianism, is inappropriate. In thinking about Keynesian economics, the issue is not whether they are being faithful to the theoretical framework of the general theory, for by this criterion, Keynes himself was ceasing by the admission he made to Joan Robinson to be a Keynesian. Of course, there is also the famous meeting, was it in the United States after around 1945, where he said, "I was the only non-Keynesian present in the room." The real issue is whether people are developing the central intuitions about capitalist economies that Keynes was trying to capture with his theory. Now, clearly, one interpretation of this argument about Keynes' tolerance towards different interpretations of his ideas is, in a sense, to rehabilitate the neoclassical synthesis Keynesianism. For we've tried to demonstrate there are no grounds to dismiss it as bastard Keynesianism. There seems little doubt that what became the neoclassical synthesis forms within the family of models the development of which Keynes explicitly encouraged. His support for Hicks, Harrod and Lerner has been mentioned. And it's worth noting that the neoclassical synthesis is based on the idea that the classical theory would come into its own at full employment, an idea that occupies a prominent place in the last chapter of the general theory and was reiterated at some point in the 1940s, in a quotation I don't have in my mind at the moment. However, to deny the illegitimacy of the neoclassical synthesis is not to defend it as the right or the true form of Keynesianism. The adoption of any line of development has both costs and benefits. ISLM picked out certain features of the general theory and made them the basis for a new set of models. Much that was also important to Keynes was left out, and here I will point out that that in a paper with David Laidler, pointed out a lot of these things that ISLM left out, in particular a whole slew of issues related to the issue of time. So we're not saying the ISLM model is perfect. The problem lay not in the use of these models, such as ISLM, but in believing that they were sufficient to capture the full Keynesian vision. Post-Keynesian economists have also captured important dimensions of Keynes' vision, though the problem here would seem to be the opposite, where the drive towards formal modelling has probably been the most significant factor in constraining mainstream Keynesianism. Post-Keynesians have arguably found it much more difficult to find the techniques and models that would enable them to test and develop their vision of how the economy works. So if the Keynesianisms of both mainstream Keynesians and post-Keynesians are limited, where does this leave the economics of Keynes? As I said at the outset, we have no desire to lay down a unique or correct interpretation of Keynes' theory on the grounds this was not the fate that Keynes sought for his own work. But if Keynes doesn't provide us with a different definitive theory of what value is his work? The answer we suggest, and we try to develop this in the final chapter of our forthcoming book, is he offered a vision of capitalism as a fragile system, prone to bouts of disorder, yet absolutely essential for economic prosperity and the preservation of liberal values, to which Keynes was passionately committed. So Keynes was committed to capitalism, not because he thought it was ethically desirable, but because it was necessary. More than that, he offered a set of conceptual tools that could be used to diagnose problems that capitalism was facing in the 1930s, which he himself applied to other wartime problems in the 1940s, and which proved capable of further development in the hands of his followers. Those conceptual tools also proved useful to people who were not, in a sense, his followers, people like Milton Friedman, who's made it very clear that Keynes provided the conceptual tools that were useful to people like him, who did not accept Keynes' vision of a capitalist economy. Now, in principle, this view of Keynes should be no more threatening to mainstream economists, mainstream Keynesians, than it is to post-Keynesians. Both groups should be reminded of their limitations. Yet, we suggest it's perhaps more of a problem, and here the people in this room can tell me that I am completely wrong, perhaps more of a problem for post-Keynesians because of the way their identity seems to have been tied up with the notion that they're protesting against illegitimate claims to Keynes' legacy. So I'll leave it there and turn over to Roberto and anyone else.
Thank you very much, Roger. So, Roberto, yes. Please.
Well, thank you, Mark. Well, it seems to me that Roger has given us a crisp and challenging historical reconstruction of post-Keynesian economics in its relation to Keynes' original contribution. If I may say so, the gist of his message is that post-Keynesian economics is basically misconceived in its claim to John Maynard Keynes' exclusive legacy, that Keynes' attitude to economic theory was much more tolerant and eclectic than it is often assumed, and that avoidance of dogmatism can serve as basic interpretive device in assessing Kant's overall relationship to interpreters. The paper concludes with a plea for what Roger has calls a richer Keynesian economics, which basically describes as an attempt not so much to be faithful to the theoretical framework of the general theory, but as an attempt to develop the central intuitions about capitalist economies that Keynes was trying to capture with his theory. Well, this is my first impression, actually. In my comment, I will ask basically the following three questions. Question one, which view of historical reconstruction is followed by Roger in his account of post-Keynesian economics? Second question, to what extent Roger's interpretation of Keynes and post-Keynesian economics is linked to his own view of what a historical reconstruction should be? And secondly, to what extent, if we take a different heuristics vis-à-vis historical reconstructions, we might end up with a slightly different interpretation of post-Keynesian economics and of the relationship of post-Keynesianism vis-à-vis Keynes' own contribution. So, point one, which kind of historical reconstruction is Roger attempting? Well, in trying to answer this question, I found quite useful to go back to Schumpeter's distinction between two different approaches to the history of economic ideas, which is, of course, a well-known distinction between history of economic thought and history of economic analysis. Let me just recall that in his History of Economic Analysis, Schumpeter describes the history of the analytical element in economics as, quotes, the history of an intellectual effort that men have made in order to understand, in italics, economic phenomena, or, which comes to the same thing, the history of the analytic or scientific aspects of economic thought, unquote. It seems to be that from a certain point of view, Roger's take on post-Keynesian economics and on what a richer Keynesian economics should be looks closer to the approach of the history of economic thought in Schumpeter's sense, primarily in Roger's careful avoidance of what we may call theoretical reductionism and in its emphasis on the possibility of a plurality of textually grounded interpretations. As such, Roger's call for a richer Keynesian economics is primarily a call for an approach to the history of thought in which the legitimacy or illegitimacy of any interpretation should, for most purposes, be discarded. This is a rather clearly recognizable heuristics, which I find very interesting, and which comes quite prominent if we read this sentence in Roger's paper. In thinking about Keynesian economics, the issue is not whether the interpreters are being faithful to the theoretical framework of the general theory. The real issue is whether they are developing the central intuitions about capitalist economies that Keynes was trying to capture with his theory. This latter sentence seems to be a very crucial one in interpreting Roger's intentions. In fact, plurality of interpretations is almost a constitutive aspect of an approach to the history of thought that assigns primary importance to what Schumpeter would call pre-analytical vision, that is, to the general conceptual framework underlying the formulation of more specific theories and analytical tools. Well, basically, having said that, and it seems to me that an important consequence of this approach is that the issue is not coherence between Keynes analytical framework and post-Keynesian economics, as Keynes, after all, in Rogers' view, was not fixed to any precise identification of theory. But the real issue becomes, to repeat myself, basically, to what extent Keynes' general theory and Keynes' subsequent contributions show a unified vision of capitalism. Having stated that, it seems to me that one should reach the following provisional conclusion about the ambitious intellectual enterprise that Roger is trying to present in his paper, and I believe also in his forthcoming book. There is much emphasis about basic intuition about what a capitalist economy is, and this basic intuition is, as we have seen, basically connected with a broad picture of a dynamic capitalist economy closely associated with notions of inherent instability. On the other hand, what is most remarkable, in my view at least, in this intellectual project, is that to a certain extent, lack of theory or lack of a fully consistent theory, rather than theory, is considered to be fundamental to Keynes' own view. In this interpretation, theoretical eclecticism is the hallmark of Keynes' approach, and the variety or the possible variety of analytical reformulations of the GT seems to be at the root of this argument. More generally, insofar as no single coherent theory is actually to be found in the general theory, according to Rogers' interpretation, contrasting analytical formulations are thought to be acceptable and actually to be expected. This seems to me the gist of what Rogers is proposing to us. This is a very interesting and ambitious project. However, I would try to ask in the remaining part of my comment whether other routes, other heuristics, other strategies are possible. Basically, the approach of what I've called history of economic analysis in Schumpeter's sense would call our attention to other issues or to other possible reconstructions of this by now important strand in the history of recent economic thought, which is post-Keynesianism. Essentially, as we know, if we focus on the analytical component of theory, what comes up is that one tends to focus one's own attention to issues such as is there a cumulative development or not in the formation and evolution of theory? Are revolutionary elements more relevant than continuities or not? And to what extent revolutionary elements are actually carried out side by side with elements of continuity? As we know, there are, I would like to refer to two, in my view, strikingly different interpretations of these heuristics, or rather applications of these heuristics to the history of economic analysis. One is by Christopher Bliss and the other by John Hicks. Christopher Bliss argued in a very clear way that any science has an inherent progressive tendency. Economics satisfies the conditions required of a science in this sense. It does not follow that economics cannot go through periods of stagnation during which there is a slow rate of progress or none at all, but still a progressive tendency can be detected. John Hicks had a completely different point of view. He wrote, when we look at the history of economics, we find that it does not fit into the scientific pattern. Economics is prone to revolutions, but they are mostly, I believe, of a different character. They do not fit into the patterns that have just been described as a scientific pattern. They are not clear advances in the scientific sense, unquote. Well, is it possible actually to find a kind of middle course between these two strikingly different interpretations, the interpretation of Bliss, the interpretation of Hicks? In my view, this is possible. So, to use Bliss's words, we have not only progress and anti-progress in this heuristics, but we can combine progress and anti-progress in the sense that it is reasonable to recognize in the evolution of economics both instances of cumulative development and cumulative improvements in a certain sense and along any given analytical tradition, and on the other hand, major switches of emphasis from one set of thematic concepts and hypotheses to another. What is interesting from this point of view is to ask ourselves whether taking this kind of middle course view, we can identify a certain persistence of thematic concepts and hypotheses when we move from one period in the history of economic analysis to the other. There have been attempts, of course, to identify this persistence, and for instance, both John Hicks and Luigi Pasinetti as well has emphasized kind of continuous switches of economists, at least since the 17th century, even not before, between an attention on for what Hicks called catalactics, namely the structure of markets and exchange, and an attention for what Hicks was still calling political economy, ultimately an attention for structures of production in the economic system. But this is just an attempt. What I want to emphasize here is that if we identify a basic persistence of thematic concepts and hypotheses, then this persistence may help us to identify the persistence also of certain structural characteristics in the economic system, which is the object of investigation. So a persistence not only at the level of ideas, but at the level of the objective structures. Taking this very broad approach, I really wonder now if we can reach some hints for what concerns the interpretation of the Keynesian revolution, in inverted commas, for the time being, and its heritage. As we have seen, the history of economic thought perspective, which I find most prominent in Rogers' account, calls attention to the role of Keynes' pre-analytical vision and to the policy implications of that vision. What this point of view does not emphasize, as far as I can see at least, is the existence of a precise relationship, if there is one, between Keynes' vision and the specific analytical tools Keynes used in order to support that vision and in order to persuade other economists as well as policymakers. If we try to combine the what I've called the history of economic thought perspective with what Schumpeter would call the history of economic analysis perspective, we are prone to devote attention to other aspects, both of Keynes' own contribution and of the contributions of people who have been trying to get inspiration from Keynes in subsequent decades. Essentially, the history of economic thought perspective would call attention to the existence of analytical research lines developed through a cumulative and sometimes multilinear process within economic theory and giving rise to different combinations depending on the historical context. This point of view, in particular, highlights that there are manifold theoretical influences. This is actually a most important aspect I would like to call your attention to. There are manifold theoretical influences at work in Keynes' own contributions, and these very manifold, the variety of these influences may contribute to interpreting the seemingly opposite routes taken by economists broadly sympathetic to Keynes' vision of capitalism in subsequent decades. Let's just take a few examples. Keynes' formation as an economist shows a considerable eclecticism insofar as the Marshallian character of his intellectual environment blends with important influences from within the discipline that are to a large extent independent of Marshall's own contribution, strictly speaking at least. One important case is the attention Keynes paid to the structural theory of the business cycle, particularly in the formulation given by Dennis Robertson in Banking Policy and the Price Level, 1926, which Robertson himself had developed on foundation laid many years before in his Study of Industrial Fluctuation, 1915. Why I'm saying that? Well, if we take Keynes' own analytical structure of in the Treatise of Money, the Treatise of Money, the fundamental equations of the Treatise of Money are built precisely on Robertson's distinction between consumption goods and investment goods, quite sensitive to the sequential causal linkages associated with that distinction. Another analytical theme is provided by Keynes' attention for the structure of interest rates in a production economy and the implications of that structure for what concerns the Wechselian relationship between natural and monetary rates of interest. Think of the well-known chapter 17 of the general theory. Last but not least, Keynes' philosophical criticism in the Treatise of Probability, for instance, of what he called the hypothesis of atomic uniformity of natural laws, makes him critical of the utilization of the atomic hypothesis in economic theory itself and brings him close to certain formulations, I would say, of political economy in Hicks's own sense. Let me quote very briefly a sentence which I find very instructive in the general theory. I have called my theory a general theory. I mean by this that I am chiefly concerned with the behavior of the economic system as a whole, with aggregate incomes, aggregate profits, aggregate output, aggregate employment, aggregate investment, aggregate saving. And I argue that important mistakes have been made through extending to the system as a whole conclusions which have been correctly arrived at in respect of a part of it taken in isolation. Now, this is not a casual remark. This is a remark which is, of course, immediately consistent with the earlier criticism of the hypothesis of atomic uniformity that Keynes had been carried out and presented already in the Treatise of Probability. Now, bring my comment to close. The complex web of theoretical influences at work between Keynes' economics goes hand in hand with his open-ended attitude to specific formulations of his work, an attitude which is clearly expressed in the passage of his 1937 Quarterly Journal of Economics article, which is quoted by Roger in his paper. When he said, Keynes, I am more attached to comparatively simple fundamental ideas than to particular forms in which I have embodied them. This must be clearly be recognized. However, and now I'm concluding, Keynes' eclecticism and pragmatical oriented view may not be the only explanation for the subsequent developments of post-Keynesian economics on a multiplicity of routes. In fact, Keynes' work is rooted in a plurality of theoretical traditions. It is not surprising that the differences between those traditions came to surface after a while, and that those differences for a long time seemed to be the characterizing feature of Keynesian economics. It remains to be seen whether the urge of a new impulse from theory to policy, which we are now seeing, could trigger a richer Keynesian economics, not only effective with regard to practice, but also capable of producing a yet unattained, and certainly not yet attained by Keynes himself, and fully general set of theoretical principles.